Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, February 28th. Members, we have four items on our agenda today. The first one is going to be an update on the jobs expansion report from DigiKey. So if we have those individuals here, if they could come on up to the table. And Representative Fabian, if you want to go up and talk a little bit about it from the testifiers table. I know this is something that you worked on last session. If you want to, you don't have to.
Your call, Representative.
So welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And Representative Fabian, I'll recognize you to just give a few words, and then we'll move on with the presentation.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. This is a big deal. And I'll let Rick get into the details, but they've done a great job putting their package together. They did a great job of getting together with the Department of Employment and Economic Development to come up with the plan. And I look forward to lots of jobs and lots of opportunities in Northwest Minnesota. So people out there across Minnesota looking for jobs, I got a place in Thief River Falls that could use some workers. So.
Thank you.
Rick Trontvedt, let him introduce himself, and away we'll go.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes. Rick Trontvedt, Vice President of Administration for DigiKey Electronics in Thief River Falls. Very pleased to be here to give you an update on our project. So I think you have slides in your packets, and I'll just kind of move through the slides very quickly. I'll keep it brief. Just to give you an update on what we're doing up in Thief River Falls, a community of about 9,000 residents. I work for DigiKey Electronics. We're a global electronic component distribution company. The first slide shows the artist rendering of our new product distribution center that we're planning to build in Thief River Falls. It's going to be featuring highly automated material handling technology, increased output and efficiency and capacity for us at an investment exceeding $300 million. The second slide, titled West Thief River Falls is Changing, is simply to show some of the infrastructure that's happening as a result of this project. You can see First Street being extended west, Technology Drive being built, a new truck route being built next to the DigiKey expansion, and some public construction at the bottom of the page, another road being built off of our parking lot. You can see where the DigiKey red oval is there. I don't know if it's in color, probably not in color for you, but you can see the expansion building approximately three times the size of our current campus at that $300 million investment level. You can also see a parking lot just to the south of it that was just built in October. If you go to the next slide, these are just a couple of business orientation slides. It's called Global Footprint. It shows our 11 locations around the world, including the three U.S.-based locations, Thief River Falls, as well as Fargo and Bloomington. We've got a small IT development office in Bloomington and a warehouse of about 375,000 square feet in Fargo, 350,000 square feet in Fargo, where we have off-site storage, and then, of course, our global headquarters in Thief River Falls. The next slide shows our sales. We grew by 26% last year in our revenues, hitting $2.33 billion, the first time we've ever surpassed the $2 billion sales mark in our company history, and that was pretty special. We had a big celebration about that. The next slide is about our employment growth by headcount. You can see we ended the year at 3,587 total headcount globally, and now we're at 3,654. We're creating jobs literally every month, and we're trying to keep up with growth. We have a 40% run rate on sales this year. We think we'll level off around 10 to 15% by the end of the year, but we can't keep up. Sales is really great. The next slide is showing a little bit for you to see where our residents live by city up in northwestern Minnesota, where this project is happening. The Thief River Falls population of DigiKey is at 1,781, and if you, the gentleman next to me knows a lot of these communities because that's in his district, but you can see adjoining districts as well, and you can see the number of people that are impacted by our project. The next slide just shows what we did in 2017, a very important date in May when you as a legislature approved our expansion and provided some benefits for us through through the MIF program, the JEP, BDPI, et cetera. In June, the city of Thief River Falls sold us a major property of theirs, and they took down their electrical utility building, and on that site we built a parking lot. And you can see those sequence of events there. In September, some of you came to join us in Thief River Falls for what we called our groundbreaking, even though we're really breaking physical ground. Next month, it was kind of a thank you period for us to thank the public officials, both local and state, for helping us. We completed our new parking lot in October, where we were on the site where we purchased the property from the city, and then we selected our general contractor, McShane Construction Company, in November. If you look at the next slide where the picture of the building is there, it's actually just kind of a mock-up kind of illustration. You can again see, you know, what's ahead now for us. We're finishing the building design. If you look at the third medallion from the left, the building construction starting next month, weather permitting. We have phased construction. This will be a facility. It's got the perimeter of the Metrodome as far as how large that is. So you kind of get a sense of how big that is. We've got three buildings within the building that we're building. It's phased construction. We should be completing that end of 2019, beginning of 2020. And then we need a couple of years to operationalize the building. So it's a 3.5-year project. And our engineers and our construction folks are cautioning me about when to say this thing's going to be completed because, you know, there's always things that come up. But that's our goal at this point in time. The next slide just shows just kind of as a depiction of what we think is going to be tremendous local economic impact. Inside DigiKey, there's many, many companies like FedEx and UPS and local HVAC and pallet companies and restaurants that are alive and well inside our facility. They're going to continue to grow and create jobs outside of the ones that we've committed to growing. If you look in our community, downtown, airport, hotels, apartment buildings, tremendous growth in amenities and people to staff those amenities in order to support our growth, just tremendous local economic impact. The next slide, entitled Job Creation Facts. These aren't necessarily new construction jobs to these people, but we're bringing 250 new construction and equipment installation jobs to the Thief River Falls area during that period of time. We've got housing. We've got all kinds of things we've got to do to keep these people fed and clothed and put up in lodging. And so we've got a lot of work for us in a small town ahead of us to do that. And we're, as you know, we're creating 100 new jobs a year, and we've committed to that over the next 10 years in exchange for some state benefits. The encouraging news I'm bringing you from Thief River Falls today is in 2017, which was just the beginning of the first year of our tracking of jobs, we created the company created 170 new jobs, 140 of which were in Thief River Falls. So our job creation goal is being exceeded already in the first year of the project. Just about done here, but the next slide just kind of goes back and shows you the value of the positions at DigiKey. We're not creating minimum wage jobs. We're creating jobs that the lowest paying entry level full time position pays $15.68 per hour, which you can see in the box there represents an annualized pay level of $32,614. In the middle boxes are the depiction of the benefits, the value of our benefits plans to the employee, totaling $25,640 for a total package of $58,254 a year. So these are very good paying jobs. We train everyone in order fulfillment and sales, in transactionary sales to start, and then they can grow their career through DigiKey. When we came to this committee, we were talking about jobs exceeding $16.50 per hour start wage, but that was the average of all starting jobs. This is the lowest paying full-time pay, $15.68 an hour, so I wanted to depict that for you. The next slide, I have just a couple of state impact slides for you to end my time. One is the fiscal impact of this project. In existing operations before we started the project, an independent study group studied this for us and showed that the value of all tax revenue flowing into the state of Minnesota based on existing operations was $415 million. The expansion will add $188 million to the state's treasury annually, so we will have a future annual fiscal impact of $603 million. So this is a tremendous boost to the state's treasury as a result of what we're doing here. And then the last slide, talking about annual economic output, which is the value of goods and services put into the economy as a result of our project. We already had a $1.5 billion existing operations economic output level. This project's adding $500 million in annual economic output, so $2 billion in future economic output. Tremendous project for the state of Minnesota. And then the last slide, our key goals going forward. Of course, our big one's hiring adequate numbers to keep up with the pace of our sales growth and the requirements or the promises we've made at the state level. Secondly, temporary housing for to support construction workers and the influx of construction folks. Third, long-term housing for DigiKey hires. When you're hiring this many people a year, they need places to live, and we've got to keep our foot on the gas with local officials to do that. Fourthly, no disruption to our customer base. We've got to do all this while we keep everybody happy so our sales continue to grow. Fifth, we've got to stay committed to safety, quality, and our core company values. And then during this whole period, and then sixth, we really have to work closely with everyone, not only at the local level but at the state level. So those are our goals going forward, and thanks for the opportunity. Thank you for your support of our project last year that resulted in such a generous offering of incentive money from the state. We're going to make good on our promises, and we appreciate the opportunity to give you this update today.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. And just very briefly, for those that members of the committee that don't know, can you tell a little bit about the products and services that DigiKey offers internationally, what it is that it is you do?
Right. So what we do is we basically, we're a company that's a distributor. We don't make anything. We distribute electronic components. So we purchase componentry from suppliers all over the world that make electronic circuit board level components. We market those components on our website. We have hundreds of engineers that work with prospective customers to understand the form, fit, and function of those parts. And then we sell those parts all over the world. And we transact in over a dozen local languages and currencies, and we have sales support all over the world supporting it locally. So we're very fortunate to see the growth. We only sell about 3% of our product into the state of Minnesota. So the world's out there. We've got, market share, a lot of market share ahead of us to gain. It's a big market.
Fascinating. And right in Thief River Falls, right?
Yep. So it's not the Silicon Valley. It's not even close to the Silicon Valley, but we're glad we're here.
And just refreshing my recollection, I believe that the two incentives we passed last year were and Representative Fabian, or maybe nonpartisan staff, can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was the $4 million set aside from within the Minnesota Investment Fund, and then the $1.6 million from BDPI.
Yes.
Was that it?
There was a sales tax rebate.
That came out of a different committee. That was it, though, the sales tax. Anything else? Or
job expansion program, no. Other than some TIF things we did locally, but we appreciate everything we were able to.
Before we go to comments and questions from members, Representative Fabian, do you want to add anything to the...
Oh, just a big sincere thanks to everybody, and I will have to also say, too, that the exemptions on the sales tax and so forth is also tied to performance standards that are written into the agreement with the Department of Employment and Economic Development. So it's not like it's going to happen no matter what. They do have to meet performance standards, and I'm sure that staff can verify that.
Yeah, we have to meet goals. We've been working with deputy commissioners from that agency very extensively, very cooperatively.
Okay. Questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman. So I have a couple questions. I was looking at the value of a DigiKey career, and that's very impressive, that whole chart. I have a question about your health plan. Is that a private health insurance or some public?
Yes, we're self-insured. The plan is administered through Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota at this time, and it's a very rich plan. It's very, very inexpensive for employees, $37 every 2 weeks for full family coverage, free if it's just your own coverage. Very few deductibles or copays to speak of other than emergency room visits. Fantastic, fantastic insurance plan, and we hope the pay and benefits gets people interested, but we hope the culture and the values and the experience keeps them at our company.
Sounds like a...
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, it sounds like an amazing... plan. Maybe I'll check that out in the rest of the state. That's amazing. I also wanted to ask about your housing for your workers, your workforce housing, how that's going.
Well, we continue to have a full court press in terms of asking private developers to come up to Thief River Falls. We would extend that invitation through anybody who can hear my voice to come up and talk to us about the advantages of building in Thief River Falls. Rural parts of the state aren't the first places a lot of developers of housing go, but we want them to come here and see the success story we're writing and come and join us and help us with that. We're working very creatively with a number of developers locally and with existing housing to renovate and make things available for the employees.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, one of the things that interests me is this is a project, I believe, Rick, you said is going to be 3.5 years in the making.
Right.
Very, very large construction project. One of the things that I've spent a lot of time on in the legislature since I've been here, since 2011, is permitting and environmental review and expedition of these permits. Where are you at in that process? And I guess the other question I would have is, are you using the business one-stop that we have set up here in Minnesota?
Yeah, I'm not sure. We do have a meeting with the MPCA tomorrow to talk about an air permit issue that's pretty important to us to be able to start our project next month. We want to make sure that we've got everything in place, and we're looking at some timing mismatches, but we're hoping we can come out of that successful.
So you have not... I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. You have not incorporated the business one-stop.
That's fire.
I don't believe so.
Representative Davian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is Commissioner Hardy here? Could I ask Commissioner Hardy just one or two questions, please?
You can ask her, but she can't compel her to come down. You can't subpoena her, Dan. So, I mean, it's... Commissioner Hardy, are you appearing before this committee voluntarily, or is this...
Whenever a member calls, I try to answer. For the record, I am Shantira Hardy. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is just kind of, I would like to introduce you to, so if there's something that...
I know him very well.
I know. So I'd like to reacquaint you, and I would appreciate it if you could be of any assistance through the Business One Stop with their permitting. I would very much appreciate that. So you can have an offline conversation. You don't have to have that here, obviously.
That's why you called her down, so she'd have the offline conversation and not have it. Commissioner Hardy, would you?
For the record, we are more than happy to do that. The Business First Stop is a body that consists of my department and several other agencies that have permitting oversight, and our goal is to make sure that as projects such as DigiKey that are complex, that require a number of different permits, that they have one door to go through, and we can be able to assist them to move through that process. And so we are committed to do that, and we will work with our partners at the PCA to assist if you have other permits other than that one.
Representative Fabian, do you have anything else?
Thank you.
Yeah, well, that wasn't that bad. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned to the testifier, you had mentioned, I think, 170 jobs this year. And one of the things in the Office of Legislative Auditor's report, they talked about part-time, full-time jobs that go along with some of these incentives. Could you tell me, are those jobs that you created, particularly, I think you said 120 of them were up in Thief River Falls.
Right.
Are they all full-time or a mix or what?
Yeah, so we...
The testifier? Just a reminder to members that we go through the committee chair, not because the committee chair insists on being part of the conversation, but just so that we have one person talking at a time. And and we always know that when I'm not chairing a committee, I always dutifully follow that rule, without exception. So... To the testifier.
Sure. So I may answer the question?
Yeah.
I want to make sure I don't step out of order. Yeah, so we basically are, there's a mix of jobs in terms of classification status, but when we say that, these are 170 new global jobs to DigiKey, 140 of them, whatever mix of full and part-time, created in Thief River Falls, assigned to the Thief River Falls location.
Representative Mahoney.
I'll stop that. I'll talk with Deed on the particulars on full-time and part-time jobs and how that relates back to any of the state incentives. But Representative Clark touched on an issue, and, you know, you're a great representative here, and I have had some words about how housing is done up in northern Minnesota and the subsidies that should come from here or there. And I know it's not your business. It isn't. How to do housing in Thief River Falls. But if you've got almost 1,800 employees and you've added another 100 and you're looking to add 50 to 100 a year, does your corporate office actually have some kind of a housing plan, housing, you know, other than just encouraging contractors to come there? Because, frankly, contractors will go where the money is.
Right.
So do you have a plan for how to increase the housing in Thief River Falls and the surrounding? Well, soon to, I'm sure there's going to be a suburb of Thief River Falls pretty soon, the way you're growing. Mm-hmm. So why don't you ask him?
Chair Grafflin.
To the testifier.
Okay. Yes, so we are in the business of electronic component mm-hmm. distribution. We don't necessarily want to get into building housing, but we're very, very interested in that. I was just at the governor's task force on housing last week speaking about kind of our experience. And what we do is we try to do a lot of the things on the periphery to encourage those things. So we have $800 relocation allowance for housing for folks that are moving into the area at any level of the company from a 60-mile or further radius of outside of Thief River Falls. We try to incentivize those new transplants to be able to find housing and to be able to get into something and not have the burden of that. We also we rent apartments from local landlords and sublease those to new folks, consultants, contractors, new employees, some, not all, but some. We, again, try to instigate where we can. We try to, you know, work with our legislative delegation if there are any state programs. There was a wonderful state grant that we received in Thief River Falls a few years ago. We did some great Representative Fabian Keel and Senator Johnson, I think it was Senator Stump at the time, did some wonderful work to get us this grant money that we were able to work with our city, and we got 105 units built, market rate units, and that was tremendously helpful. Of course, they rented up right away. And so we try to work with local and public, local and state officials as much as we can to instigate and to try to be able to take advantage of anything that's out there.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you. No.
Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Any closing comments, Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just want to point out, too, that DigiKey is a company that was born and raised in Thief River Falls by Ron Stordahl, and it is still owned today solely by Ron Stordahl. And his heart and his commitment is not just in Thief River Falls, but it's also in Minnesota. I've had the opportunity to talk to him a number of times. He's very, very appreciative. This is a company that's on very firm footing, and it's got a very, very bright future thanks to the innovation and the creativity that he has demonstrated in his leadership of this country. And I guarantee you, if he was sitting in this room today and I asked you to pick him out of the crowd, you wouldn't be able to do it. He's that unassuming. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, thank you for your presentation, and we look forward to hearing continued successes from you in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank all of you.
Okay, Representative West and those from Summit Academy. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Representative West, if you want to begin an introduction, and then we'll proceed with testimony from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to be joined here by Summit Academy and Jay Sean and Louis King. They have done, I visited them early on in my legislative time, and I was completely blown away by what they're doing. And it was very exciting to see such a successful project, and we're going to hear about what they've been doing. And I was happy to carry their legislation to help them keep doing the good mission they've been doing for a while now. And nobody wants to hear him from me as much as he can make his case a lot better than I can. So I'll just turn it over to Louis King here.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Louis King, President and CEO of Summit Academy OIC. To the members of the committee, thank you for having us today. And I want to thank Representative West for his support and the subsequent funding of our GED program. Summit Academy is a nonprofit vocational training school located in North Minneapolis. We believe that the best social service program in the world is a job. We simply do one thing, train and put people to work. Our specialties are healthcare and construction. You might have seen in the New York Times on Friday where we were featured for our work with Mortenson and getting people into the construction trades. This is particularly important as we face a demographic shift in this state, and we need employees to keep us going forward. A couple of years ago, Summit discovered that was a silent epidemic in our community. 72,000 people in Hennepin County did not have a GED. To give you some comparison, the population of Brooklyn Park is roughly 78,000. When we talk about disparities, 20,000 African Americans in Hennepin County do not have a GED. The population of Golden Valley, men, women, and children, is 20,000. Therefore, we figured we'd take a swing at this. We also decided not to treat it as a K-12 issue, but to treat it as a workforce issue and to partner with business rather than pointing fingers at the schools. I'm a former school board member. Schools don't lose arguments. So we left them alone and went to the business community and came to you, partnered with Commissioner Hardy, and here we are today. I'm proud to say, and you have in your handouts, that we reached, after a little bit over a year, our 100th GED. This is very important, a very important milestone for us. We launched the 1,000 GED campaign as a way to bring attention to this issue. We partnered with private sector, and our goal is to raise $5 million to date. We raised 2.2 from foundations and $500,000 from individuals, in addition to the money that you provided. We're well on our way. A little bit about the people that we serve. 74% of people of color, 56% African-American, 60% male, 40% female. Average age is 28. 82% we're living below 165% of the federal poverty line. 49% were unemployed at the time they came to us, and the average wage was below $11,000. Upon leaving Summit, the average placement wage is $33,592. We paid $500,000 for a longitudinal study and concluded that 82% of our program participants were employed 3 years after enrolling at Summit. We feel very good about these results. We think that this is a very important endeavor. I recognize the need for pre-K, early childhood development, but the truth is these children go home to adults. And when these adults are not stable, when they don't set example of work, when they don't take care of their own families, it sets a bad precedent for the children, and I think we would generally agree we cannot raise their children for them. On the horizon, in July of this year, we will launch an IT partnership with a group, Atomic Data, and begin to train people in cybersecurity as well as help desk. Currently, if you're not interested in construction or healthcare, we don't have anything for you. So we want to diversify so we attract more young people, bring them into the workforce so that they can become leaders in this community and raise their own families. At this time, I'd like to introduce Mr. Jayshon Coleman, who is a student at Summit, started off in the GED program and is now in a pre-apprentice electrician program.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record so 100 years from now we know who you are.
All right. Jayshon Coleman. And I'm a student at Summit, like he said, from the phase 1 out of 2 electrical. And I walked in with no GED, you know, no education. And within 10 weeks and a lot of hard work and support from the staff, I walked out with the GED, and now I'm currently enrolled in their electrical program. And I just feel like it's a great help. It's a diverse school, you know, it's culturally and age diverse. Like you said, the average was 28. I'm 22. You know, we got grandpas in there, grandmas in there. So it's really cool to learn and walk out with the trade, you know, from not having an education at all to having a career to look forward to.
And Mr. Coleman, you said you're 22 years old?
Yes.
Well, that's good news. You're a little bit older than Representative West, who's sitting right next to you. So, I'm sorry, Mr. Coleman, was that the completion of your testimony?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Mr. King, a quick question for you. With regards to partnering with the trade unions and these blue-collar jobs, are those people, are you finding the resources from the trade unions? Are they partnering with you? Are they being helpful? Are there any things we can be doing to help facilitate that relationship more? I know there is there is a shortage out there in the workforce right now.
Mr. Chair, if you'd asked me that question 15 years ago, we'd have a very long conversation. Today, we've established our credibility in terms of putting people in. We built two stadiums, Union Depot. The carpenters ran an experiment and determined that our people had better retention than folks that they brought in or folks walking in off the streets. We have an active partnership with the electricians and the carpenters. And quite frankly, Mother Nature's in charge at this point. We were not prepared for what's upon us, and it's structural and permanent. So what we're beginning to see now is the people who got the jobs with the first two stadiums, and you might have read it in the article, are becoming foremen, supervisors, and ultimately superintendents. In that case, social networks will kick in, and they will begin to bring people in the same way that Swanson and Johnson did. As the demographics change, the complexions of the labor unions will change also, and it won't be affirmative action. It will simply be supply and demand.
Thank you. Representative West, do you have any other testifiers? Any questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's always good to hear the progress of this organization. It's very impressive, and I think your reputation with the construction trades is exemplary. I'm just wondering, I haven't heard much about the healthcare part of the work that you're doing. Could you expand on that a little bit? What kind of training you're able to offer and how, so that's one question. The second question was, I thought it was really important that you're tracking your students 3 years after. That's really significant data. So if you could just talk about those two issues, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark. We refer to our healthcare as the softer side of Summit. Of course, we put construction in so we could get young men off the streets and so that they could act as fathers rather than threats to the community. The healthcare program consists of the community health worker discipline, which seeks to educate communities of color on taking advantage of preventative measures rather than utilizing the emergency room is a primary means of obtaining health care. In addition, we move, and it also offers a certified nursing assistant. In addition, we also train in medical admin, and that the woman who's at the front desk at United is a Summit grad. And the administrative side runs the gamut from that job through insurance processing. The healthcare component makes up one-third of our enrollment, and as you might imagine, is dominated by our young women, although we have men in it as well. In terms of the 3-year performance, that was based on a longitudinal study that we had Rainbow Research conduct. The entire experiment looked at them over a 5-year period, 2 years before Summit and 3 years afterwards. We currently track our people out to 365 days, and we maintain an active bench because of the cyclical nature of construction seasonality, and people do turn to us for sources of labor.
Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Clark, are you not?
I was going to just ask, can you tell me a little bit about the wage structure for those employment opportunities?
Mr. King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, would you repeat your question, please?
I just wanted to know a little bit about the wage structure for the employment opportunities for health care.
Oh, certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, the health care folks range from $29,000 to $30,000. Some of the community health workers, primarily working for the county, go in at higher wages. We deliberately chose not to focus on certified nursing assistants because they tend to be at the lower range. Our theory is never based on one income in the household. It's always based on two. And that is the leading cause of the disparities that we discuss. When you talk about African-American incomes, you're typically talking about a single head of household. When you speak to the 63,000 of the white community, there are two people. So if I can get my young men and women both to get jobs in their mid-30s, and I have three daughters, an unemployed boy is not good marriage material, period. If we can get these young men in a position where they are earning and they can combine their incomes with someone else, we can then begin to build families and communities. We've tried everything else.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to kind of like remind this committee that a few years ago we were responding to wages in the black community falling behind. And so I just want to say to the chair of this committee and the body, thank you for responding to that need and investing in an organization in a company like Summit OIC, who is really transforming and creating able-bodied providers for themselves in our community, and just reversing that narrative that was out there and creating, you know, skilled, educated, and networks that is really attaining, you know, family-sustaining employment. So I just want to say thank you for your hard work and commitment to creating a skilled workforce for the community, but also for this body to, you know, invest in those organizations that are out there in the community doing transformational work. So this, like, comment for both of us, yeah.
Representative Moran. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe it's just I'm not reading the piece correctly, but I think in the demographics where you have the income, living 82% living below 165% of poverty, and then your pre-enrollment wage is 11,000, I think something's wrong there. But that's not a real big issue. I wanted to compliment you on your training of the support crafts to the construction world. I'm just wondering if you'll be so successful when you get to the major industries, or major crafts, I should call it.
Was that a joke? Was that a joke? All right.
Mr. Chair, can we just move along?
Yeah, I think we will. Quickly losing control of the committee. So the seeing no further comments or questions, Mr. King, did you have anything, closing comments, or Representative West?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your support. Representative Mahoney, I'll check the math. We do have one initiative we're going to bring before you. Actually, two things. One, the demand for people in the IT is not going anywhere. And so we're going to get out there and provide leadership around that issue. Our initial partner is Atomic Data, and we're going to use that as a learning ground and get back to you on how we want to expand it. The second thing that I want to leave on your mind today is that we need to focus on the workers of the future. And I think that our youth development elements are woefully behind. With the emerging workforce, communities of color, when we look at what's happening with those kids coming out of a high school, there's a big opportunity there for us. And that's something that in the coming months we're going to sit down with you and talk about. your ninth. I was meeting with Greater MSP yesterday after the 20 year olds. That's your ninth grader 5 years from now. But we've got to think about them that way and begin to invest in them in real, and it takes business to get involved to do it. So those two things you'll find us exploring in the coming months. And again, thank you so much for your support.
Thank you. And Mr. Coleman, thank you for your testimony. Wish you continued success in your training and apprenticeship programs you participate in. Mr. King, thank you for your leadership. And Representative West, thanks for authoring this bill last session and bringing it to successful conclusion. Thank you all. Members, the third and final agenda item we have is the release of the Office of the Legislative Auditor report on the Minnesota Investment Fund. And members, this report was released today. At, I'm not sure anyone besides me had a chance to read it today, but the it's in your packets, and you can feel free to take it and read further on it. But as always, the legislature on a bipartisan basis holds the Office of the Legislative Auditor in very high esteem. It's a great way for us to be evaluating programs and seeking improvements to them. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for OLA's Program Evaluation Division. And before Mr. Alter and Mr. Kirchner get into the presentation, I just wanted to pause for a moment and first say thank you for hearing the release of this evaluation. And second, just to remind you that we are doing this evaluation in response to legislation you all passed in 2015. In 2015, there was a section added to our part of the law which dictates us to conduct an evaluation of an economic development incentive program every year. So this is our second such evaluation. Last year we did one on the research tax credit, and this year we're doing one on the Minnesota Investment Fund. So it's yet to be determined which economic development incentive program we will evaluate next year, but based on the current law, we will be doing one. So I just wanted to remind you that that's an ongoing obligation of our office. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to the co-managers of the evaluation, and thanks again for hearing our evaluation. Thanks.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Joel Alter with the Legislative Auditor's Office. David Kirchner is going to be assisting with the presentation in a moment. And I also want to mention Madeline Welcher, who helped us with this evaluation. The Minnesota Investment Fund, or as it's often called, MIF, is a business subsidy program created by the legislature. And the intent of the program is to create jobs, retain jobs, and create investment. Overall, however, we found that the impact of the program is not as clear as we would like to see. It's hard to distinguish what activities the program has induced versus those that would have happened without the program. In addition, we observed that the process for creating MIF projects is a complicated one. We think local officials should always be consulted about these projects, but we think it's unclear that local governments need to play a direct role in administration of the program. And finally, we think that decisions regarding MIF projects should be more consistent and transparent. Before we discuss our findings, a little bit of background about the program. The MIF program is described sometimes as Minnesota's workhorse economic development program. While some other economic development programs have restrictions that limit their use to certain types of projects, the MIF program is often more flexible. It was created by the legislature in 1996. At the state level, it's administered by the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Over a recent five-year period, DEED awarded funding to an average of about 20 businesses annually. When a business applies for a MIF subsidy, how much does MIF typically award? Well, the average is about $500,000. If it's in the metro area, it tends to be a little higher than that. Outside the Twin Cities area, a little bit less. And since 1996, more than 300 local governments have participated in MIF projects. Usually these are city governments, but they may also be counties or local economic development authorities. And if you're interested in the report on page 17, there is a map that gives you a little better idea of at least regionally where the projects have occurred in recent years. As I said, the program structure is a bit complicated. Rather than DEED simply giving subsidies directly to qualifying businesses, the process has additional steps involving local governments. First, in response to an application submitted jointly by a local government and a business, DEED makes a grant to a local government. The local government then uses the grant to make a loan for that same amount of money to the business. The process often takes time because there are separate legal documents that have to be developed for both the grant and the loan. In most cases, the business is allowed to keep all or a part of the loan without paying it back. This happens if the loan is designated as forgivable and if the business meets its project commitments. If all or part of the loan is not forgivable, this means that the business has to pay it back. The local government is allowed to keep some of the repayments. By law, the local government can keep 40% of the repayments up to $100,000 per project. And the remainder of the repayments come back to the state, and they can be reused for other MIF projects. There are not a lot of restrictions in state law regarding MIF, but there are some that are worth mentioning. First, there are certain businesses, certain types of businesses that the program cannot subsidize. Professional sports facilities, casinos, and stores principally used for retail sales. Second, state law caps MIF grants at $1 million per project. The legislature, as you heard earlier, sometimes chooses to designate recipients of MIF grants in law, and it often does that if it wishes to grant more than $1 million. An example other than the one you heard about earlier in this hearing, in 2015, the legislature authorized a MIF grant of $4 million to the Cirrus Aircraft Corporation in Duluth. Third, the law says that the MIF award may not exceed half of the project cost, and the rest must be borne either by the company's own resources or private financing or other public sources. And finally, there's a provision in state law that establishes a compensation floor for employees of a company receiving a MIF grant. And David's going to be talking more about that later, but in our view, that provision of law is vague and needs some clarification. There are two sources of funding for MIF, state appropriations and loan repayments. There was a long period of time from about fiscal year 2005 through fiscal year 2013 when not much money was being appropriated to MIF. In fact, during that period, there were 6 years with no money appropriated in those years. And then starting in fiscal 2014, that changed. Appropriations jumped to $15 million that year and remained at that level for the next 2 years. As you can see in the early part of the period, loan repayments were an important part of the revenue picture. In recent years, they've averaged about $1 million a year, but they've been dwarfed by the program's appropriations. This next graph shows the starting balances in the Minnesota Investment Fund in recent fiscal years. The starting balances that are shown here do not include the state appropriation for that year. So, for example, if we look at 2016 and we're seeing a starting balance there of about $23 million, and added to that would have been the appropriation of $15 million in that year. So what we see in recent years, at least, are some pretty healthy balances, starting balances, certainly better than the early years that are shown in the period on this graph. One important trend is that increasingly the loans provided through MIF have been partly or fully forgivable. And again, this means that the business does not have to repay all or part of its MIF loan, assuming that the business meets its job and wage goals that it's committed to. So in effect, a forgivable loan is a conditional grant. The business can keep the money if it meets those conditions. The bars on this chart reflect the number of MIF projects annually in each of the past 20 years, and the blue portions of the bars show the number of forgivable loans. Until fairly recently, the norm was that most loans were repayable loans, but over the past several years, most loans have been fully or partly forgivable. And to put this in dollar terms, between fiscal years 2013 and 2017, DEED awarded $53 million for MIF projects, and of that total, $40 million was forgivable if the businesses complied with the loan conditions. It's not uncommon for businesses to add jobs after receiving MIF subsidies. Nevertheless, there are a lot of unknowns about the true impact of MIF on job creation. I know some of you are familiar with the term a but-for test, And in general, for economic development programs, the state does not want to be subsidizing developments that would occur within the state anyway without state involvement. Ideally, the state should only subsidize projects that would not occur but for state involvement. When DEED provides MIF funding to a project, it is not required to make a finding that state assistance is essential. The MIF application does ask why MIF financing is necessary for a project to move forward, but we observed as we went through project files that the responses from businesses and local governments were typically brief and not very well documented. The result is that we can't be sure that MIF was really responsible for all of the job creation in these projects. For example, in 2014, DEED initially awarded a $1 million MIF grant to a Brooklyn Park business. The business later decided that it wasn't comfortable with some of the requirements, the MIF program requirements, and it turned down the money. But it went ahead anyway and completed the project. And in a case like that, you say to yourself, well, was MIF really essential for that project? What we recommend is that the legislature amend state law to require stronger assurance that MIF is essential to individual projects. And specifically what we suggest is that the businesses should either have to demonstrate that they do not have access to financing that would enable the project to proceed, or demonstrate that the proposed job gains would likely occur in another state. DEED has reported on the extent to which MIF has helped to foster private investment, but we think those reports have been overstated. DEED has suggested that over a recent 4.5-year period, more than $2 billion in private investment was leveraged by MIF. We found that more than half of that reported leveraged investment was from a single project, and in fact, that project did not leverage the $1.2 billion that DEED claimed. Just to say a word about that project, in 2015, there was a Lakeville company called MOM Brands that was bought out by an out-of-state firm called Post Holdings for $1.2 billion. Months later, the company applied for MIF funding for the purpose of keeping one of the company's headquarters in Lakeville. But contrary to what DEED has reported, the MIF funding that Post Holdings eventually received through MIF did not, in fact, cause that sale of the business to occur. It had occurred much earlier. That was the largest overstatement of leveraged investment that we saw. There were others. And again, I think we had the general concern that because the MIF law doesn't have a but-for test, it's hard to know what portion of the investment by MIF-assisted businesses is truly attributable to the program. I want to shift and talk a little bit about the local government role in MIF projects. DEED plays the lead role in program administration, but local governments have supporting responsibilities. They jointly submit applications with businesses. They are parties to the key legal documents, the grant contract with DEED and a loan agreement with the business. But keep in mind that most local governments don't do MIF projects very often. Over the 20-year history of this program, there have been a lot of local governments involved, but the typical number of projects per local government that has participated is one. So local governments don't know this program by heart, and it sometimes is a challenge for them to administer their part of the program. DEED's application form instructs local governments to do financial underwriting of MIF projects, but we found that DEED hasn't adequately helped local governments understand what that means, and so some local governments have struggled. Earlier, I said that local governments are allowed by law to keep a portion of MIF loan repayments. DEED has required local governments to put that money into local revolving loan funds. And some local governments have used that money to offer subsidies to businesses. But we found that many have had a hard time doing so. Nearly half of the local governments with MIF-created local revolving loan funds have not spent the money from them in the past decade. For example, Redwood Falls has not spent any of its local revolving loan fund, perhaps because it has only about $40,000, and it may be difficult to entice a business to relocate for that amount of money. But on the other hand, a city like Eagan has $250,000 in its local revolving loan fund, and city officials there told us that they're not really in the business of making loans, so they just haven't used that fund in the last decade. Meanwhile, state law has no provisions regarding the local revolving loan funds. It doesn't require that they be created, and it says nothing about the purpose that they should fulfill. So we think that the legislature should consider a couple of actions related to the local government role. First, we think that the legislature should consider streamlining the MIF process. Rather than having this kind of complicated process where the money goes first to the local government and then to a business, we think the deed could be making these loans directly with businesses. It would be a simpler approach. It's a state program with state dollars, and we think it's reasonable for a state agency to be fully accountable. And although we recommend that the local role, the formal local role of local governments be eliminated, those local governments can still play important roles in these projects, helping businesses with their applications. The city councils could take positions on the projects. They could certainly provide input to deed. We also think that the legislature should consider repealing the statutory provision that allows local governments to retain a portion of the MIF loan repayments. As we said, many of the current local revolving loan funds just don't really revolve. That is, cities have found it hard in some cases to spend the money in these accounts. If the repayments came back to the state, this would either allow for more MIF projects to be funded, or it would allow the program to continue with reduced appropriations. So let me turn it over to David Kirshner, who's going to talk more about how the MIF program is administered.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, for the record, my name is David Kirshner. And as Mr. Alter said, I'm going to talk a little bit about DEED's administration of the MIF program. As Mr. Alter said, DEED has quite a lot of freedom to administer the MIF program as it sees fit. There are not very many restrictions in the law about how DEED uses MIF funding. DEED can set its own policies regarding which businesses will receive assistance, how much money they will receive, and whether or not those MIF loans will be forgiven, whether or not the companies will have to pay all of that money back. We have some concerns with how DEED makes each of those three types of decisions. I'm going to start first by talking about that first one, which businesses receive MIF funding. There is an application process for MIF funding, and DEED scores the applications it receives to see if businesses meet the minimum threshold. There is a 400-point threshold that they're supposed to meet. But we found it was pretty easy for businesses to meet that threshold. And partly that's set up by the structure of DEED's scoring system. Many points are given for pretty modest accomplishments. For example, any business creating just 10 jobs receives the maximum amount of points available for job creation, which is 100 points, one-fourth of the total. You don't get any additional points for creating 50 or 75 or 100 jobs. 10 is all you need to create in order to get the full amount of points for the job creation. We also noted that a number of the items on the score sheet are scored subjectively. They're scored by loan officers based upon their review of the application. And we found, frankly, that some of those loan officers were pretty generous in the points that they provided. For example, officers could give points for economic vulnerability, communities that maybe need some particular special attention because they're economically vulnerable. And such communities as Cottage Grove, Plymouth, Lakeville, Eagan receive points for that economic vulnerability score, despite the fact that their median household income is far higher than the state average. Lastly, it sometimes seemed to us as if DEED made decisions before it even scored the applications. In quite a few cases, DEED told businesses in writing that they were provisionally approved for MIF funding, including the award amounts and whether or not the awards were going to be forgiven, before the scoring process started. Now, those letters did usually indicate that the award was contingent upon DEED's scoring and approval of the application. But our review of internal DEED files suggested that DEED staff often viewed these as departmental commitments that the department really ought to follow through on. In one instance, for example, there was a business where DEED issued a press release saying that the business would receive a $1 million forgivable MIF loan 4 months prior to the scoring and the awarding of that loan by deed officials. Deed's criteria for the second two decisions, how much money to provide and whether or not those awards would be forgiven, were frankly a little bit of a mystery to us, to be honest. Deed does not publish its decision-making criteria. There are internal written criteria that the department uses, but when we went through a large number of files, we found that most of them didn't follow those internal criteria, and there was no documentation in the files explaining why those criteria had not been followed and why additional money had been given or not additional money had been given. When we asked Deed staff about how they made decisions, they made a point of saying there is no algorithm, that every award is unique, every business has a unique situation, and consequently, every award is decided independently based upon the judgment of Deed staff. However, Deed did not document the reasons for any of its judgments in the files that we reviewed. They just provide the businesses the money. As you might expect from a fairly subjective process, we found that there were some substantial discrepancies from one project to the next. It was not clear to us, for example, just to take an example that we put up on the slide here, why we have two projects here, one in Maple Grove, 31 jobs, $27 an hour average wage for those jobs, and that project received $700,000 fully forgiven. The business did not have to pay that money back, assuming it met its project goals. And yet we have another business in Delano, similar number of jobs, a little lower in terms of the average wage. It received a $750,000 award, but that award was not forgiven at all. That company will be paying all of that money back to the state. We did not see a whole lot of documentation or support for why different businesses were receiving such inconsistent outcomes. Expenditures of state money for any purpose should be transparent, consistent, and governed by explicit policies. And these expectations are especially important when the state is giving public money to private businesses for private purposes. Especially given the recent increase in funding for the MIF program, we recommend that the legislature put expectations like that into law. The legislature should require Deed to publicly specify the criteria that it uses to determine which businesses will receive MIF awards, how much they receive, and whether or not those loans will be forgivable. Those criteria should be specific enough that someone knowing sufficient details about a project beforehand ought to be able to come up with a reasonable prediction of how much money that the state would provide. In addition to our concerns about the award decisions, we also thought that some of Deed's administrative procedures could be improved. For example, businesses agree to hire a certain number of individuals and make a certain amount of investment in order to receive a MIF loan. However, we found that in some instances, the businesses were allowed to count hires and were allowed to count investment that were made before the award had been made by the department, which once again raises the question of the but-for issue, whether or not the businesses actually needed that support in order for the project to go forward. We also felt that Deed's monitoring documents were not as complete as they should be to show that the businesses were making the hiring that they had promised to make, and that the department does a poor job of identifying not public information that it keeps in its project files. One administrative problem that I want to draw particular attention to is the wording of the loan agreements that set business obligations. We found that when businesses applied to the program, they often said they would pay fairly high wages, those that Deed made its decisions about what to provide those businesses based in part on the wages that the businesses said that they would provide in their applications. However, if you look in the report that we provided you on page 58, you can see that the difference between what the businesses proposed and what Deed actually required was often quite substantial. Take, for example, SciTech Engineered Materials in Winona, which proposed it would pay employees $25 an hour, but then the loan agreement that the business signed, which was actually the requirements that it had to meet in order to receive the MIF funding, only required the company to pay its employees a minimum of $12.45 an hour. A little further down, like about the fifth row, Corvita Medical proposed it would pay $41 an hour, and that was the basis upon which Deed made the award it made to that company. And yet the legal agreement only required that company to pay $17.50 an hour to its employees. So generally, we think that Deed ought to tighten its administrative procedures. Lastly, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot I had one more slide on this. We did want to point out that one thing that Deed has actually done reasonably well has been to limit the financial risk to the state. Deed has done a pretty decent job requiring collateral to make sure that businesses can pay back the loans that they receive. And we also noted that Deed was pretty diligent about following up when companies had not met their obligations under those loan agreements and reduced the size of the loans or required the companies to pay money back to the state. So we did want to give it credit on that account. Now, lastly, I want to talk about one additional recommendation that we have for the legislature. As Mr. Alter noted, the MIF law requires that businesses that participate in MIF pay a minimum compensation level to their employees, 110% of the federal poverty guideline for a family of four. This provision in the statute is very ambiguously worded, and it's not clear exactly how it ought to be interpreted. It's not clear whether the provision applies only to newly hired employees or to all a business's employees. It's not clear how long businesses are bound by this provision. And because the poverty guideline changes every year, it's not quite clear which year's poverty guideline ought to be enforceable for a particular business. And so we strongly encourage, or rather we recommend, that the legislature clarify that provision in the statute to make it clear what businesses are actually bound by with regard to that minimum compensation requirement. And with that, Mr. Chair, we are finished with our presentation, and we are very happy to take questions from legislators.
Thank you very much. Before we move on to questions and comments from members of the committee, I do know that Commissioner Hardy is here, and I think it would be appropriate to give her an opportunity to address the committee if she so chooses. If not, Representative Fabian will subpoena her again. Welcome to the committee once again. Please restate your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today to respond to the Minnesota Investment Fund Program evaluation. For the record, my name is Shantair Hardy, and I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, DEED for short. I thank the Office of the Legislative Auditor for its review and efforts to assess the complexity and impact of the Minnesota Investment Fund, also called MIF for short. Since 2011, MIF has provided funds to more than 100 businesses, helping them add a projected 8,400 quality jobs throughout the state, leveraging more than $1.5 billion in private investment. Deed has invested $53 million in those projects, representing a leverage of nearly 30-1. This excludes the post-holdings project, which the auditor referred to in their cited report. Still, a good return on investment for the state. Minnesota's incentive programs like MIF are modest relative to finance programs available in other states. However, they remain critical components for the community and business competitiveness and play a key role in business expansion and relocation decisions, especially in greater Minnesota. Businesses have many options when considering new or expanding operations. MIF serves as a necessary incentive to compete against offers from other states and spur investment in Minnesota, as well as critical financing tools for businesses that are already here but want to grow. As the report notes, Deed continues to do a good job maintaining and managing the program's finances, and there's little risk to state funds. We continue to have sound internal controls and ensure funds are managed properly with well-constructed legal documents and effective clawback processes when businesses do not meet their performance commitments. Deed has made many important improvements to program administration and transparency, including investment in new technology to better manage our transactions. And to note, with respect to the auditor's report, there were a number of projects selected before we've made improvements to our technology and our protocols. And so those projects, with respect to the oversight, do not reflect that. I will say that we are disappointed that the OLA doesn't highlight these improvements nor recognize our commitment to continuous improvement. Moreover, many of these improvements address the report's recommendations, some of which were based on project activity occurring prior to implementing these improvements. Many of these issues identified in this report have been addressed by deed and will be solved with many minor adjustments. I will also say that we're surprised that the report made conclusions on the value of MIF without discussing transactions with individual budgets or deed. Any project fell on its own cannot provide the personal insights and dynamics of the value of MIF that are gained through discussions with participants, with community leaders, with elected members. We often spend months, if not years, working with businesses and communities prior to applications to ensure that those projects are viable projects. Hundreds of communities and businesses are strong supporters of this program, yet the report minimizes their perspectives and highlights views from a small number of interviews with local government officials. MIF has been the game changer in so many projects throughout the years. I will conclude by reiterating my appreciation of the recommendations of the OLA and look forward to improving the program even further using the report as we've done with past OLA reports. We're committed to continuing to help businesses grow and create jobs for Minnesotans utilizing important tools such as MIF. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak, and with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. And then seeing no comments or questions for you, thanks again for being available, and thanks for the responsiveness. And members, there's in the report itself, there's a more detailed response from the commissioner as well. So thank you again.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll go back to members' comments and questions regarding the OLA report. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And although I didn't get a chance to read the whole report, I got to about two-thirds of it. And so you weren't the only one that was had some fun this afternoon or today. I'm not sure if this is there are some things in the report I wholeheartedly agree with. There are others I wish the report would have been able to broaden its scope. The MIF program as compared to what other states do and the restrictions on those particular programs, and I have made a point over the 20 years I've been here to take a look at what other states, whether they're the Southeast or Northeast or the Western part of America, and let's just say that they are a bit loose on their requirements also. I'm being really, really kind to many places. A governor has shown up with a state checkbook once or twice from other states. So, but I don't disagree. We do need to have more understanding of what it's doing, what MIF is doing, and where it's working. And to many of the requirements, the changes that have been recommended in the local loan fund, the local involvement, some of the wage, the job numbers. We have tried very hard. Some of us have tried very hard to make these changes over the last 15 years. And because of political pressure from members within the two chambers here have failed. Obviously, these particular programs don't rise to the level of front page news that we all like to get. And when you do reform, if one person in these two chambers is upset, that can really put some sand in the wheels. But I wholeheartedly understand and would like to see some of these changes that have been proposed here, and I'm happy if the chair is interested in doing some of these. I'm happy to bring up some of my old bills that could probably address some of these issues. And then one last final comment: the report does talk about they use nicer words, but the hypopoly of enlarging the numbers. And most of us that have been here more than a couple of years when departments come in, when agencies come in, when organizations come in claiming that they've done wonderful work and they're the next best thing to sliced bread, we do tend to take some of those with a grain of salt. Claiming a $1.2 billion might be a little bit of a stretch, but we're used to exaggerated claims around this particular complex up here. So much of what is brought forth in this report is not not unknown, has been, people have tried to fix some of these particular problems, but because of political pressure, whether it's from a particular organization or one of our colleagues up here, have not been able to get some of those things done. But again, this highlights what and how we can fix some of these programs. And if there's the will and the backbone to do that and take on some of these institutions that come and tell you that if you change this, we'll all go down and burn in hell, we could do a better job with the monies that we have. So, Mr. Chair, that's all my comments for today.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not sure maybe if the question goes to Ms. Hardy or to OLA. One of the things that really concerned me here is the subjectivity of how the loans are being made. First, what got my attention was that as the funding has gone up, the amount of forgiveness has also gone up. And that bothers me from the standpoint that if indeed it was a good idea to have people paying it back when the funding wasn't there, and we're taking taxpayer money and we're putting more money into this, then are the criteria for the forgiveness being more subjectively applied and more liberally applied because there's more money there to do it? So what that drives is this idea of the subjectivity of how these things are being done. And what I'm reading in the response is that the department has implemented provisions several years ago to really overcome this, and that's why I didn't know if maybe Ms. Hardy might be a better person to ask that to than yourselves. But if maybe first, though, if you want to give a little more detail on anything that I said, kind of fill in that blank.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I think that one of the things that we struggled with in doing this evaluation was in trying to determine why the department made some of the decisions that it made, and that was in part due to the lack of documentation that we were able to find in the files in terms of, well, why was it $400,000, or why was it forgivable, or anything like that. The department can certainly speak for itself, but we did ask the department some of these questions, and they gave us a number of different answers. One certainly being that, yes, when there's a little bit more money available, it makes it possible for them to have a wider array of things that they may offer to companies. Another thing that they said is that it is the case that there are now a fair number of consultants out there who are consulting with companies and suggesting to them that they try and push for a forgivable loan because they know that the consultants know from having done many of these that they are available in a way that a company who's coming to deed for the first time might not have that same knowledge. I think the other thing that Deed would also say is perhaps that there has been somewhat stronger demand for the MIF program as the economy has improved. There are more businesses wanting to grow than there were maybe 7 or 8 years ago. That being said, those are broad characterizations that they have made to us. We could not substantiate them by looking file by file and going through all the documentation that Deed had provided. So that is an explanation they have provided to us, and they may be able to give you more details on that type of explanation. But what I can say is that from our process of reviewing these projects in great detail, we weren't able to substantiate those reasons because there simply wasn't documentation for why the decisions were being made.
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair, as a follow-up, I'm not if Ms. Hardy may have something to say about that. I'm not sure.
If you...
I leave that for the person over there.
Commissioner Hardy, did you want Representative Vogel to restate his question for
yes.
you? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Hardy. What I'm looking at is your response on item number two, where it says the legislator should require stronger assurances, and you say the department has already implemented provisions several years ago to address them. Just curious, because it bothers me that it is subjective, what you have actually done then that to overcome, I guess, some of the difficulties that were just explained.
Commissioner Hardy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, just a couple foundational pieces. With respect to the files that the OLA pulled, most of those were closed files. And they were not all of the MIF files. And so these recommendations are generalized over a sample of the files. Many of the requirements that we put in place were in 2015. With respect to the factors that we consider are high levels of capital expenditures, high levels of job creation, high wage levels, economically distressed area or similarly distressed factors, and likelihood of expansion locating outside of the state. And so those are the factors that we put in place and we work through. And to the testifier's comments related to the responses that he received from our team, those are accurate in terms of what goes into deciding with respect for loan forgiveness.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you. As a follow-up, Mr. Chair, I can't find it right now. As I was going through this, it seems to me there was a side-by-side comparison of two companies that were of similar nature. I'm not sure where it is in the report. It was
page 54.
Is it 54? Okay. And they look very similar to me when I was going through this thing. And that's where I was wondering what the question on the specifics of the process that's been put in or the criteria that's been put into, I would assume, a policy that people are following.
Absolutely.
Commissioner Hardy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm going to have Deputy Commissioner Kevin McKinnon come and be able to speak to the specifics of that example.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Kevin McKinnon. In response to the question, I believe it was a side-by-side of Silpro and in Delano and Price Mechanical in Maple Grove, I believe.
Yes.
Those two projects in particular, Silpro was doing a local expansion, obviously, and Price Mechanical was not located here. Price Mechanical is based out of Winnipeg, actually, with operations in Arizona and one other state that I just don't recall off the top of my head. And through the negotiations and through the way that we work with projects and communities, it just so happened that this company required or wanted forgiveness of this loan. Otherwise, it was going to go somewhere else. And so in this case, this is sort of an example of what we have done to make this happen in Minnesota.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I guess what I was looking for relative to the response is I would assume then there is now a written policy that gives points or whatever so that this is objectively done rather than subjectively done. I think that was what I was getting at here.
Mr. McKinnon.
Generally, Representative, we have guidelines that the auditor has talked about that represent the amount of forgiveness based on the amount of job creation. Certainly with wages and those types of things go into that evaluation. In some cases like this, there is some As the auditor has pointed out, there are some there is some flexibility on our behalf to make that happen. And in some cases like this, that's the determination that ultimately was made.
Thank you. Representative Mo-
okay. Thank you. One more.
Mr. Representative Vogel, last one.
Thank you. And I guess if I could just have some comment on your thoughts on the but-for. It seems like a legitimate thing that should be in here because this is taxpayer money, especially with forgiveness, is basically a transfer of payments probably from one business who is paying the taxes to a business that's receiving the money. So you'd want to make sure that, indeed, they have to have this. Have you addressed the but-for, or are you considering doing something like that in policy and procedures so it's well-defined?
Mr. McKinnon.
Representative, you will likely note that there are other programs that have been created through deed, and as Representative Mahoney had discussed, we have talked about that in front of this committee over the years. This is one program that does not require, obviously, that. Internally, yes, we try to stick to our guidelines and do what is required to try and make something happen here in Minnesota. And in this case, there is no specific policy on that to date.
Okay. Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner, is part of this that many times when we're working with recruiting businesses and they're looking at options, that part of this is you're almost in a quasi-negotiations with the business, and that sometimes different businesses are requesting different things. Is that a component to it that is difficult to codify or put in policy?
Mr. Chair, that is true, and there was some mention about the hiring of consultants. Unfortunately, businesses are very serious about other locations when they do spend that kind of money to justify and make good decisions about why they operate in one state or one location versus another. And so when we get in those situations, it is competitive. Yes.
Okay. Representative, oh, geez, we all, Representative Rarick, then Layman, then Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you described the scenario here regarding the mechanical contractor based in Canada and then Arizona, made me wonder, when you're negotiating this with them, as part of your decision, are you also looking at if we give them the grant to move in, are we considering what adverse effect that might already have on existing companies? Because these 31 jobs that are created might just be coming from an existing company.
Mr. McKinnon.
That's a very good question, Representative. And the answer is yes. That is definitely taken into consideration. A mechanical contractor might be the wrong term for this company. This is the type of company that actually makes the cooling systems that go in buildings, and they sell their product all over the United States, and actually that's quite a sizable market. We have several of those types of companies that are here today, global companies that are here in Minnesota today, and there is a very large market that they all participate in. We absolutely do take a look at that and consider that. We generally try to stay away from businesses who are really dependent on our local market for selling their products and services. We're really focused on people who are trying to sell their products outside of our state.
Representative Layman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my questions, too, are for Mr. McKinnon, I guess. I recognize that the MIF fund is a staple of deed, and it's an important tool for you. And I also recognize that economic development is not it's a messy business. And it does involve, like the chair said, a lot of negotiation. And sometimes negotiations are pretty hard to document in a file. And so when you go through and do an audit, you don't see the intricacies and you don't see the context. So I just need to say all that as a former economic developer. But a couple of questions. I wonder if some of the problems with the fluctuation in the amount of forgivable loans and so on doesn't have something to do with the unpredictability of the funding of MIF. And so maybe part of the problem is we don't have long-term predictable funding so that in years where you're flush, you know, you feel a little freer to give, you know what I'm talking about? So I'm just wondering if maybe you could speak to that, if you know, what the uncertainty of the level of funding does to your administration of the fund. And then number two is when I look at the map of how many loans are made in the last 9-10 years, I see that not very many are made in the greater Minnesota area. And so I was kind of surprised to see that Deed adamantly opposes the idea of giving direct loans, because I do know that there's many small communities out there that really do not have the ability to make loans and even administer this kind of money, and so the money's sitting there unused. And that's been a struggle that I've heard again and again from small communities. So I'd like you to just speak to that. Why would you not? I mean, you can still develop relationships with local communities without running the money through them. So those two things.
Mr. McKenna.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, the unpredictability of funding, it's been fairly predictable the last couple of years, but as noted, it wasn't for many years. Having said that, you know, generally when we are talking to businesses, we are not starting with, we're going to give you a forgivable loan. That is not what we do. We do our best to try and recoup all of those funds back, so then we can continue to lend. Over the past number of years, we've been in a very good economic environment from an expansion perspective. We've captured a lot here in the state. A lot of good things have happened. From a greater Minnesota perspective, a lot of the provisions that you see within some of the other programs that we have, for many years we really didn't do much in the metro area. And I think that's pretty well documented as well. As Job Z started to end and prior to the Job Creation Fund starting, MIF became a little bit more of a program that we would use for that type of forgiveness, but also that at that time, again, we were on the way up and we were hoping to capture as much as we could, obviously, and as we came out of the recession.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I wish philosophically we didn't have to have MIF in the state of Minnesota. I really do. But Representative Lehman made the comment that long-term and predictable. Well, I think that in many business areas in the state of Minnesota, the only thing that's long-term and predictable is how difficult it is to do business in Minnesota. The business climate in Minnesota is one that's ripe for other states to come and pick off companies that are here. And I have the good fortune to represent a company like DigiKey. The governor of North Dakota sat in Ron Stordahl's office and tried to recruit him. They were recruited to come to other states. I respect, Mr. Nobles and I have an excellent working relationship, and I'm not criticizing the report. But I am stating, I mean, companies today are extremely mobile, and we're in a highly, highly competitive economic development market. And sometimes the flexibility that's built into the MIF program, and there's probably others, is something that's maybe essential to being able to retain and recruit businesses. I talked about DigiKey. I have the good fortune to represent them. I also represent Polaris, Marvin Windows and Doors, and Arcticat. And all of those companies were started by somebody just like Mr. Stordahl, who had a vision, who had a dream, who had an idea. And every single one of those businesses have been through economic cycles. But the other thing that they've also done is they've also grown and they've expanded their business footprint. And from my perspective, too much of that business footprint expansion has come outside of the state of Minnesota. It's in Osceola, Wisconsin. It's in Spirit Lake, Iowa. It's in Grafton, North Dakota. It's in Fargo, North Dakota. It's in Huntsville, Alabama. And it's all over the world in some cases. And a lot of those decisions are made because that's where the market is. When Polaris moved to Poland, it's because of their European market. I'm just simply saying that we need to come to the realization that we're in a highly, highly competitive business market. And sometimes it's messy, economic development. I respect the work of the legislative auditor, but I also have to tell you that the Department of Employment and Economic Development and what they did to help us retain DigiKey, I can't imagine what Thief River Falls would be going through today if DigiKey had decided to move. It would be absolutely devastating. And quite frankly, the amount of money that was put into that project over a 10-year period averages out to, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. McKinnon, about roughly $5 million a year, maybe a little bit less. If I gave each and every one of you $5 today and told you to go down to the local VFW and buy some pull tabs, and I guarantee you you're going to get $186 back, and if you don't, I'll take it out of my pocket and give it to you. That's what the DigiKey expansion has done for Minnesota. So I'm sure we've got some issues to work through here, and I know the chair's got his gavel in his hand.
No, neither.
So, and I'm not going to subpoena Commissioner Hardy, but thank you for your indulgence, members.
Representative Mahoney, you get the last word. I just it was oh, Representative Clark. So Mahoney, go ahead. Representative Clark.
Oh, I thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll go. Two things here. I don't have the information in front of me, so it's a tough question to ask. But I would like us to get an answer sometime in the future. But I believe Minnesota actually has a net gain of businesses. On a year in or on a business cycle, whichever word works for that. And I'd love the department to come back someday and actually show us, because there's this huge falsehood that Minnesota is a horrible place to do business, but periodical after periodical, whether it's Wall Street Journal or Kaiser Foundation, comes out and says Minnesota is a great place to do business and we do it well. So I'd love Deed to come back someday with a more detailed statement on our net loss and net gain of businesses. Business is hard to do anywhere. But to and then another piece that I want to make sure everyone is clear on, and I know the department has provided me with the number, but I don't have it here with me. We talk about the geographic distribution in MIF. And what we as a state, we as a committee, need to look at is the geographical distribution statewide. The 9-county metro area always contributes more to this economic development statewide. I believe, and I, again, I'm doing it without the documentation back to my office, but I think the greater Minnesota outside that 9-county metro area gets about $1.25 to $1.50 for every dollar they put in, and the metro area gets between 50 cents and 75 cents back for every dollar we put in. The 9-county metro area, Carver, Hennepin, Anoka, Washington, Ramsey, Dakota, pay the bill for almost all of this outside of that area, all of the economic development that goes on. And, you know, it takes bright people, whether it's in Thief River Falls, and obviously you've got bright people up there doing a great job, or, you know, down in any other particular place. There's a shrimp farm going up someplace, I think. And I'm happy to do that because if we hollow out Greater Minnesota, we as a state lose. So I just want our members on the committee to understand not to beat up the metro area. We're not the evil ones here. We're trying to help everybody else. And every once in a while, a pat on the back would be much better than a kick in the shins.
Representative Clark, get the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just trying to find the place in the report where they talked about the but-for test, and I just now found it. But I have a question, and I don't know if this is for the auditor or for staff, but I think part of this is being governed by 116J, right? And when we're talking about that, having been one of the original authors of that bill many years ago, one of the things we talked about is that part of the criteria is public purpose, and so that's one thing I didn't hear when you talk about but for that, you know, there would be no other place they could get the funding. I think the other thing that's really important to look is what is the public purpose. For example, helping a business get the kind of money that it needs to help make a whole area flourish. And then the other thing is the quality of the jobs. And I believe that's part of 116J, too. I don't have it in front of me. But that's why there was wage levels put in there. You know, so but for, you know, I mean, I know a bank might be willing to give some funding, but they're not going to have the same criteria to look at. They're not going to necessarily look at those issues of wage levels and public purpose and, you know, those sort of things. So I guess since that's part of our existing economic development law, I just want to say but for is too simple a recommendation to look at, I think. It needs to be more complex, just like the law itself is complex, so that you have these additional factors. And I just wonder, whoever would like to respond to that, I'm talking about the spirit of how we do economic development, I guess, in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, I think the point is we agree completely. I mean, I think we didn't talk today a lot about the fact that there is in the MIF law a public purpose that is stated. And because of that, it's a given that projects should keep that in mind and that they should serve that public purpose, whether it's job creation, job retention, having wages that meet the criteria that are in the law. Those are all kind of givens that projects are supposed to comply with that public purpose. And so I think we're simply saying that in addition to those public purposes that are stated in the law, when we decide which projects are worthy of funding or not, it makes sense to apply some additional criteria and ask whether this is a business that has no options for funding elsewhere, or if it's a business that's likely to go out of state. And that's what we're suggesting as some additional criteria to consider.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
So, again, saying having no options for funding elsewhere is too simple, because the business to get a small or even get a significant loan, but if they can't provide the kind of benefit package, for example, that we saw with DigiKey, or other businesses, you know, it seems to me like I just want it to be looking at the whole picture, because, and I don't know, maybe you'd like to hear from the staff,
Mr.
too.
Mr. Chair, members, the law is very specific on the floor and the 110% of federal poverty guidelines with mandatory benefits and then benefits on top. As well that many companies provide. We see a variety of packages that are offered from businesses to their employees. Some range, you know, from $2 an hour, $3 an hour on top of your wage that's in benefits, to some are $8, $10, $12 dollars, as DigiKey would be a great example of having a pretty solid benefit package. That does come into play when we look at some of the wage levels, and particularly where this comes into play is more so in Greater Minnesota perhaps than the metro. And we do have some general wage guidelines and benefit guidelines that what we do see in Greater Minnesota might in many cases be maybe a little bit lower on the benefit side than what you might see in the metro area. So Is there consistency to it? Is there consistency across every business? The answer is no.
Members, we've reached the end of our allotted committee time.